Welcome to a Republic of Consciousness podcast for small presses, brought to you from the University of Westminster and the Contemporary Small Press Project. Joining me are our two resident literary critics, Catherine Taylor and Jonathan McAloon. A little later on, we will be joined by our guest reviewer, Ellie Williams, to discuss Hang Him When He's Not There by Nicholas John Turner, published by Splice. But before that, we'll briefly touch on my trip to Trieste, discuss the Man Booker winner, Milkman, with Catherine Taylor, after which Jonathan McAloon will announce his Small Press Book of the Month. So who wants to hear about my trip to Trieste?
Trieste.
Well, I guess we're going to. So me, definitely.
Catherine is right. We have to vocalise the last vowel, Trieste, although it does sound slightly phony. That's all right. A Trieste is the best day. I think what is interesting about Trieste is that Joyce is everywhere. And it's also empty. The coffee is a euro.
The coffee's a euro all over Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's Illy coffee comes from Trieste. It's one of the big parts of their economy. But actually, I don't really want to talk about Trieste. I want to talk about the fact that I read Patrick Modiano's Young Once while I was there.
So we were talking about that last time, weren't we?
We were talking about Patrick Modiano. Yeah. And did you read Young Once as part of your...
No, I haven't. But there wasn't there a reissue of Villa Trieste? Didn't he write a book called Villa Trieste?
I don't know. I didn't read that. I should have read that, shouldn't
yeah.
I?
Yeah.
Young Once. Have you read Young Once?
No.
It's extraordinary.
Who publishes it?
The New York Review of Books.
Ah.
But it was apparently his breakthrough book when he slightly he simplified his style, and it's so simple. It's a bit like, I mean, the only person I can think of is Hemingway, in the sense it's the prose is so straightforward, so without embellishment, but somehow over time, this atmosphere is released, where you feel that you're in the existential world of these young people. But without any sense of interiority, without any sense of the writer trying to, I don't know, reveal things to you. It's an extraordinary, almost a kind of miraculous achievement to have such straight prose, and to deliver this extraordinary atmosphere. And then there is a brilliant idea. So it starts off with a family who are 35. They're both husband and wife, both about to become 35. Then we go back to how they met at 19. And the book's called Young Once. And then we have their first year of their life, which is when they were young. But actually, and I won't give it away, they then do something which allows them to live at the age of 20, to really live, which is actually when they are allowed to be young and really live. And we don't learn anything about that. It's this extraordinary trick of just saying that there are moments when we are young, when it's really hard and grim, and then we suddenly become who we are, we get an opportunity to become who we are, and then we really live. But he doesn't give us that. He gives us the middle age and that moment of hard grimness of being young, but all just without, it's just this kind of effortless prose. Nothing to do with Trieste, but I read it there in bars drinking.
You're just trying to make us envious, aren't you?
Coffee and and Campari spritzers. But anyway, while I was away, the Man Booker Prize book-like things now, I guess they are.
Man Booker Prize for fiction.
For book-like.
For finest fiction.
For Man Booker Prize for book-like things that tell stories in, you know, a variety of ways, was announced.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a reaction, I hear.
Well, there's always some kind of reaction,
yeah.
Whether it's a foregone conclusion reaction or whether it's a disgusted reaction or whether it's a delighted reaction. So I think the point about this winner, Anna Burns for Milkman, published by Faber, was not one of the favourites to win the prize. Mm. And there was quite a lot of surprise at her win. But also, I think the subsequent, almost immediate news stories and commentary, mainly from people who actually hadn't read the book, was how outrageous it had been that this complicated, difficult book had won, and how booksellers would be unhappy and how readers wouldn't be able to get on with it because it's challenging. And of course, that's been absolutely refuted, the fact that it's sort of struck the top of the bestseller lists, and everybody I know who's read it has loved it. And I think it sort of says something about this culture about books and book prizes, where we're supposed to be insulted by a book that we might have to work a little bit harder at.
So just to clarify, I haven't read much of Milkman, but what I've seen is totally not what's made out. You know, people say it's this stream of consciousness about a woman growing up in Belfast during the 70s and kind of balancing the troubles with unwanted attentions from various men. And people talk about it in these comment pieces, not reviews, by the way. Another thing that's happening is people are not reading the reviews, and they're saying, this review in the Telegraph is... The Telegraph gave it 5 stars, but then later you've got these comment pieces. Everyone says it's stream of consciousness, but it's not. It's just voice-led. And in the same way, in the same way Augie Marches or The Curious Incident of the Dog of the Nighttime is. You know, it's just a voice which has boundaries.
Let's start from the rather damning with faint praise comment by the chair of the judges about how, oh, climbing Snowdon, which isn't actually that difficult to do, even if you're asthmatic like me. You know, it's like climbing Snowdon, you get to the top and there's a great reward. It sort of set the scene for, oh, God, this book is going to be a real
slog.
And so, of course, you have that in your mind. You know, I was lucky enough to have read it way before it was shortlisted. So I didn't have all of that, you know, I didn't have other people's opinions in my mind. She's also making a commentary on a particular, let's say, political and societal setup. And I think that the language that's used and the narration is all part of that. And that's what I mean about it being, in a way, like a play. Everybody speaks in this strange, unconventional, fairly very rich, intricate way in this book. So
why?
But also, it's really charged with politics,
isn't it? That's the author's device, isn't it? That's that, you know, it's interesting because I found it totally immersive. You know, to me, that she was writing in a different way about a time of conflict and trauma and a place of division and subterfuge and fear. And she was choosing to express it in this extraordinary, almost grandiloquent, formal style.
Yes.
And I thought that gave it even more of a surreal edge, and I think it really worked for the book.
And is it almost boyfriend or maybe boyfriend?
It's maybe boyfriend and maybe girlfriend. And I think the fact that it's maybe is because it shows the precariousness of the situation that they're living under, this you know, this just sectarian.
Can I just also take this back away from what happens in the book? I want to talk about what's happening around it and potentially the implications for, I mean, look at this podcast for small presses, right? Books released by them. Chances are a lot of the books published by small presses are more risk-taking than other bigger publishers might be wanting to get behind. What does that say if a lot of readers, not you, Neil, but the hypothetical reader, the one who kind of writes the comment piece, isn't willing to, even, you know, even if this is more complicated than we think than it actually is, even if it was, what would that say for more challenging fiction?
Well, exactly, and
right,
and
now,
and to me, we are going to find that challenging fiction absolutely, as you say, when certainly while judging the Republic of Consciousness Prize.
Yeah,
I mean, and I'm actually surprised this book isn't on the Goldsmith shortlist, because to me, it has that innovation and it should be there. You're looking absolutely horrified.
I'm not stunned by it. I don't know what I'm saying.
Glad you had been.
No, I think it's interesting because I think what happens is what is allowable inside the Man Booker has been narrowed. So this is at the extreme end. Of Man Booker shortlisted or winners.
Is it
Lincoln in the Bardo was more
yes, that's
that direction, the one you're talking about.
That's true, but Lincoln and the Bard was always Lincoln and the Bard was
because it's written by a man.
But it was also
men are allowed to write challenging books, women aren't.
But it was. I'm not sure. Yeah, we may
drop your mic, Neil.
No, okay. I'm not saying that that's Neil's point of view, but as a lot of what I felt with the comments around the Man Booker winner were that the three previous winners, and it had been pointed out by others, that their books were no less difficult or challenging. If that's the way that you view this particular
novel. Well, Marlon James, half of that was written in a kind of patois, again,
absolutely,
first person.
Absolutely, but nobody said, oh, you know.
And said, oh, this is quite difficult to read. I'm not going to bother with this.
And you know,
HBO
what you're saying,
bought it.
What you're actually saying about the extreme end is quite interesting because I think the Man Booker hasn't really narrowed that. It might have narrowed in some terms, but actually what it's doing every year is it seems to me that it can't make up its mind what it is, whether it's the Goldsmiths 1 year or the Costa the next or whatever the Booker. Ethos is that particular year, because it is obviously widened by including, as we discussed very briefly last time, the graphic novel, the long poem, the narrative verse, which was a book that was called in. So, and the, you know, the genre fiction. So I think this is a, in any other year, any other prize, this wouldn't be seen as a bold choice, really.
I mean, the bits I picked out of the reviews is they would somehow go to booksellers, and booksellers would go, oh, this wasn't our choice. You know, our choice was a slightly less in the terms that we're talking about.
Very much insulting the reading public there, I think, by assuming, first of all, assuming that everybody wants to read the same book and that one book has to fit the size of the prize. And the other thing is that, absolutely, that people can't cope with fiction.
Absolutely.
I have to say, of course, it's kind of about context. And I came to this thinking that it was going to be a much tougher, and gritty and actually slightly disturbing read.
This is a very disturbing read, but you've only read 50 pages. No. It's a very menacing, disturbing read. I don't know if you mean in terms of its theme or if you're talking about its...
It's got a lightness of execution, actually.
Well, that's all credit to the author because she's talking about deeply disturbing.
Again, you're also talking about
issues.
You're also talking about coming into it with an expectation. I think again with the chair of judges talking about Mount Snowden. You know, there was the other thing about I've read Harder Philosophy. It's like,
well, that was also
it's an
silly.
Own goal for any reader. You know, it's the literary equivalent of way has to come out when someone says something like that, and then they deserve a bit of backlash. Just a shame that it had to be about a book.
It also shows that you can't win. You know, I've read a lot of books set in this part of the world and a lot of books about the Troubles, and this was one of the most original books that I've read on this topic. And it resonated with the Me Too movement. If you go further into the book,
I can see what's coming.
But it could have been set anywhere in any kind of dictatorship, and I think that's why it's one of those universal books. But it's also very specific to Belfast and very specific to the background of the writer as well.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Catherine. With us as Build, Ellie Williams, last year's winner of the Republic of Consciousness Prize for Small Presses. With Influx Press for Attrib and other stories. And then she went on to win. And then I've got ... because I lost Wi-Fi connection. I couldn't Google. And I knew it wasn't the Desmond Elliott because...
I just won generally.
Won every
life
prize.
Became a celebration.
What did you... It was set in Scotland. It was given to you at the Edinburgh Book Festival, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the James Tate Black Memorial Prize.
Right.
For fiction.
And isn't that the oldest literary prize?
I think it's one of the oldest ones. Which was a complete privilege.
£10,000.
Yeah, all to the writer, whereas with our prize, you actually only got a third of the pot. Attrib got, not Attrib, Influx got the rest of the money. But anyway, welcome, Ellie, to our second slightly chaotic Republic of Consciousness podcast. Was more
irreverent, presses. As I prefer to think of it.
But before we talk about the book... we're going to hear a few words that have been previously recorded from the guy who set up Splice. And so we'll hear from him from a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back and we will, Ellie, if she's willing, will lead the discussion on the book, but very much how you want to play it.
Sure.
Okay, so by way of introduction, here are a few words from Daniel Davis Wood, who is most certainly not from Birmingham.
Well, I'm the one who kickstarted Splice, and it's very much a reflection of my passions, my outlook as a person with a commitment to literature. I'm a writer myself, I write novels and I write literary criticism, and for me it's really crucial that those two parts of my own writerly identity are kind of equal and bound together, inextricably, really. Basically, I think every worthwhile work of literature sort of casts a shadow of literary criticism anyway, or it speaks to a gap in the literary landscape because a writer gives it the contours of something that they feel is missing and ought to exist, ought to be written. And then also for me, the only critics who are really worth reading are those who attend to the artistry of literature first and foremost, and understand books as created things, and then search out the features that make a book a work of particularly literary art, rather than focusing on the things that translate easily to cinema, theatre, or other forms of art. And so I envision Splice as a vehicle for publishing this type of literature and also promoting this view of literature. And this type of literature, of course, is mostly published today by small presses. And so Splice's online activities involve putting small press books into the hands of artistically minded critics who are going to give them the sort of close and detailed attention that they tend not to receive in the wider, larger media, and in this way connecting the books with receptive readers. And then in print, I search out this type of literature wherever I can find it, in development, in workshops, in manuscript form, in the slush pile. And I'm really concentrated right now on publishing first books by unconventional, adventurous writers, and then using Splice as a platform to increase their odds of producing more future work and helping them to continue do what they're doing.
We now move on to Hang Him When He's Not There by Nicholas John Turner, published October this year by Splice.
So... Ellie, do you want to tell us a bit what this book is, what it's about?
Tricky one. Yeah. In many ways, it's a collection. In many ways, it's a mosaic. In many ways, it's billed as a novel, but a form that I hope we're going to interrogate. First person, second person, strange third person, illusory, elusive. It feels sharp and has sharp edges. It's very difficult to like many of the characters, and I'm sure we're going to talk about liking and likenesses throughout the book, but it really is unlike many other works I've read recently. I think the voices that are established here and the weird dreamlike and nightmarish whirlings of imagery that keep ricocheting and spiraling out of control, but are still held together with networks of association and anecdotal, conversational quips and asides and funny, wry strangenesses. It's a real rattlebag. What did you make of it? What were your impressions of it, having put it down?
When I started it, it seemed very much for a sort of surfeit of similes. No, I mean, I'm not saying that in a negative way. It's very sort of self-consciously written, of course, but I think this type of book is. It reminded me a bit of a book that we discussed last time, which is Gabriel Joseph Avicii's Cemetery in Barnes,
yep.
Where you have the unreliable narrator or narrator syndrome. You have the sort of forking paths leading lots of different directions in that kind of Borgesian style. And what I loved about it is that it's set in the Antipodes. I think that's, to me, that not just because I have a Antipodean background, but I think it's because there's a lot more scope with these vast landscapes and of both of the mind and of, you know, externally. So that's sort of what I was mostly interested in when I started reading it.
I was completely conflicted about this because I don't think it was billed as a novel necessarily, but the blurb on the back from a newspaper described it as a novel. Mm. So I was expecting, for a while, I was expecting more linkage even from between stories which weren't necessarily chronological or or linked that obviously. As you go through, you do realise, yes, each story sort of has a counterpart and a continuation. But because it was billed for me as a novel, I just kept feeling like this writer can do a lot and they're not unifying it for me in a way that I can enjoy, in a way that interests me. You know, this Nicholas John Turner is extremely intelligent, extremely adept with language. I'd absolutely argue against the, you know, the kind of the overload of similes. I think he's very good at placing language.
Yeah, no, I didn't disagree with that. I just said that it comes at you like a volley.
Yeah, yeah.
From the beginning.
And it gives you a lot of what you can't be asked with as well. Like there's lots of voices which, oh, he's getting into a zone. And you could do without that, and you could do with a bit more of this. And so my main takeaway is probably the least helpful thing a critic can say to an author or about a book, which is, why did they have to write this one? You know, because there was so much brilliance.
Do you think that means that he's stuffing it with as much as he can? That he's trying to write, obviously, quite a few different types of book. Sorry, a few different types of book, or short story, or narrative nonfiction within one book. And do you think that's why, as you said, there wasn't a unifying aspect to it? What, and Ellie, did you feel, you know, you haven't actually sort of given a...
No, I sidestepped that sort of... and did a kind of matador twitch, yeah, of a blanket. Exactly. And say, like, no, come through. Because I also only halfway through thought, wait, is this a novel? Have I misunderstood this? And in doing research, it seems like maybe other reviewers weren't too sure how the reader was supposed to position themselves in taking this as a full, complete text, yeah, or whether this was a kind of patchworking together of different complementary texts. So one part is, or one, many of the parts are set up as letters or playing, riffing on the idea of letters. So they'll end on sincerely. And often it is sincerity, both of tone, form, image, that is the unifying factor for me. So at one point, it kind of, one of the short stories is set out as a lecture about the veracity of an author. Yeah. One part is, or many parts actually, are written as as letters, as I say. Other parts are in this first person, very conversational, eliciting a you, but at one point, one is very clear as the reader that you is not the reader. It is this agent Vel that we are supposed to believe is a mishearing or has been misheard as ancient hell. And often miscommunication and an inability to be explicit while being also very explicit in imagery seems to be a recurrent or a re-emergent, revenant theme or process within the book that is unifying, but it did feel scattergun, the form of it. When I found connections between characters or between situations, I really felt very satisfied as a reader, because I thought, yes, no, I get it. That was the daughter, or that was the nurse at the nursing home. But I did feel it as someone maybe noticing threads, unifying a collection maybe, rather than what I would expect from a novel.
So almost you felt almost like an editor being like, yes, that does work as a...
Yeah.
That does work.
So we're concentrating a bit on it being billed as a novel, aren't we? Does it matter if it isn't? Or do you think
how
many of our expectations are formed by marketing, essentially?
Yes. Yeah.
So I remember when I reviewed Claire Louise Bennett's Pond, and that was actually marketed by Fitzcarraldo as short stories, but to me it's one continuous text. And the fact that it was marketed as short stories made it ineligible for the Goldsmiths Prize that year, which I thought was terrible.
And the Booker.
Yeah, exactly. But so, you know, how much, we're talking about what we've got preset.
One of them is a preset thing, and one of them actually is how it comes across. And unfortunately, I think both of us, you and I, Ellie, were, you know, we had to research to see whether the other reviewers knew exactly what they were getting into. I think that we are informed by a blurb on a back or by the whatever, but also we're informed by what it is once we've finished reading it. And we were talking earlier about, you, Neil, described the Booker as a prize for book-like things. not necessarily novels.
Now,
because you hate the fact that poem was...
Not despite the graphic novel and crime.
Well, there we go. I think this is... we've got a case of a book-like thing.
But we have a novel-like thing that's not quite... I mean, going back to the Booker with David Chalet's...
All That a Man Is.
All That a Man Is, which is essentially short stories of different men at different stages of their life. What I felt about this book was that I relaxed the moment I knew it probably wasn't a novel.
I felt the same.
And then I suddenly thought, because three stories in, I just thought that this guy not only can really write.
Yeah, he really can.
He can really write. He's doing something really bold and intricate. I have no idea, especially the guy, the proofreader who's turning up at a house. I'm not even sure whose house he's turning up to.
To interview the novelist.
To interview the novelist, and then he sort of sees domestic stuff going on through the window.
Yes.
Something on that is just...
But he also subverts what you think about it, because
he assumes that this anonymous, or for a lot of his career, anonymous author is a man.
That's right.
But he misses, yeah, he
And
gets
he also,
it wrong.
About the child that he is,
yeah.
You think... It's setting the scene up where you think there's some kind of, immediately you think there's abuse going on, or whether it's a child remonstrating, or who is the dominant figure in that exchange.
Yeah.
And I think you're kind of wrong-footed almost from the word go, and as you continue.
I mean, I wanted the parts to join up, because I wanted to see someone who writes so well with such intricacy and intelligence join the parts up. I wanted to be super rewarded.
Yeah.
Not just rewarded. And I was rewarded all the way through it. But
that's
I kind of
in a segmented way,
yeah,
perhaps.
But I wanted to come away thinking here is someone who on debut has written a masterpiece.
Yeah.
That is both short stories and a novel.
It's a lot to ask a writer, isn't it? But I do think
the first.
I sort of think he could have done it as well, and that's the thing. I think that.
But
actually,
then maybe he can do it.
But he didn't.
But he did.
He had the choice. I think with his skill, he had the choice to do that. Once he started linking everything together,
I wonder how much the editor has an influence in any of this.
But no. I also wonder.
It's such an ambitious project, though, isn't it?
It is. Mm. That's the thing. On the Magical Podcast, you can't see how slim a novel it is, or a book, and that there are so many recurrent images. The nursing home, the idea of this woman lost and rereading a book that is lit by fireworks, later there's a character called Art who abandons his academic career to become someone who works in a nursing home. And you're like, this must be figures almost just missing one another or seeing the fallout from other situations. And I definitely felt like they're treading the same corridors, but we're not letting them interact necessarily. Or if they are, I've misunderstood it. I didn't think that was necessarily a failure of the book or the writer, but that, as you said, Neil, the triumph and the satisfaction I had was segmented, rather than at the end I thought, how did he pull that off? Or it has been pulled off. It felt like set pieces and really enjoyable, polished. It talks about polishing.
That I think when you start reading it, you think, oh yeah, this is actually going to be some kind of conflagration at the end, and it's going to carry on like that, because it's such a sort of high velocity beginning.
He's a gifted stylist. He's a very smart writer. But actually, he does character really well. But he does it in quite an unusual way. They're there. You suddenly glimpse them, and then he will slightly shift away and make it. He will do something slightly odd. But it is a novel that has people in it. I think there are unpleasant people, which I think you were saying. And actually, unpleasant in a way that I found quite unusual.
Yeah.
They were like properly unpleasant.
I thought he made good choices of who he was going to depict. Strange choices.
They're very painterly, actually. I was just thinking of this, just read very briefly. Yeah, it's almost like something that a model that Lucian Freud might paint, about the woman when he arrives. Mm. I wait unannounced at the doorway and observe her in her ever-present. Her starchy grey-black hair is tied up in a bun and the loose hairs make a kind of aureole that is lit up by the window behind her. She is a horror of obesity, balancing even as she sits, knees splayed, the shapeless dress of an islander woman draped over her Danish flesh. Her feet, one bridge atop the other and bare beneath the table. These are two strange arced masses. Her ears alone are small and elegant. She raises her head first and then her smudged pupils lift up to illustrate the small square glasses whose chain droops across her shoulders. It is impatience that always greets me, though I might have been missing or standing right there forever.
Yes, no, I remember, yeah. No, he's
very ungenerous at times.
Well, ungenerous, and I must say that women's bodies are depicted in a kind of categorization throughout about how morbidly obese they are, what their breasts are like, the hardness or firmness of their nipples. Like, there is a recurrence there that because if there are different narrators, that is interesting, and it's saying something about how women are viewed or how they are evinced. It does get repetitive, though, yeah. I found.
I noticed that.
Yeah. It comes across a line of sight thing, doesn't it? It's an author thing rather than a...
Right, and a kind of othering, like in that portion where it's talking about these brothers, I think, waking up and finding what they thought was this young lie that's called a Negrita in the text, next to this kind of corpulent, flabby, older woman. And the reader is supposed to take this in quite a phlegmatic way. And yet it's about horror of obesity, as it's mentioned there, or at least for this reader it was, which felt not about the narrator or the cruelty of the narrator or the shock of the narrator. It was more about objectifying what an attractive woman was.
And a general point of view.
Authorial point of view.
When repeated, becomes kind of...
becomes proven and... yeah.
Jaded.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But, I mean, you mentioned there about eyes and about lines of sight, and throughout there are these extraordinary metaphors and similes for eyes and for staring. I think at one point, a male character... the depth of his eyes is like looking down into the holes of socks.
That's
like,
very just, early on, isn't
right,
it?
Right, yeah.
And that's one of the, again, that's what I think he starts in this very uncompromising way. And that's the way he just goes on. He doesn't, it's almost like what you were saying about the kind of show and tell of a writer. It's all there immediately. Mm. And yet, they're almost tour de force.
Yes, I mean, yeah. I mean, one wonders... He's too gifted a writer to have. We
Did
don't.
He squandered it all on one book.
Well, I mean, I was talking to someone saying he's, you know, there is you do feel that there are two or three stories here would make a single novel.
I just have to say at this point, when Ellie mentioned the length, it's less than 100, fewer than 160 pages.
I mean, on many, many levels, it's a triumph. It's levels, it's ambition. Yeah. It often hits that.
And it can do lots of things. He can be really funny.
Yeah,
like that story about the cult.
Mm. Oh yes,
it was brilliant and kind of terrifyingly cruel and just really funny in a slapstick way, all together and wonderful.
But I do wonder whether there's something about his enterprise which he's saying I'm. This is what I can do, and
it's definitely showing off.
And we are not quite clever enough to have spotted the form. Maybe he hasn't pulled the form off. But there was the one thing I felt was, and I did say this to someone else. It's like he's built a world. He's stripped away so much of the infrastructure, so much of the scaffolding. Then he stripped further away and further away. And we can see all of this super distilled, but no one in the book can. Right. In the sense that they're all in a completely populated world. They're in a full and rich world. But we're not. And I'm not quite sure. And that's an odd... that's an odd orientation for a reader to be in, where. So I mean, I emailed the publisher to say this is, it is quite unusual to have something so uncategorizable as a debut piece of work.
Well, I think that's terrific, though.
Yeah,
that's great. And that's kind of enough, isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. It's kind of like, well, you've done. You know, you may not quite have delivered a slightly prosaic satisfaction that we all wanted of wrapping it up and giving us and kind of going, oh yeah, we were right, we kind of followed that one. You haven't done that for us and we feel a little bit bereft for that, but everything else you've done,
but there's nobody here that's been disengaged from this book.
No, right. No. You pick it up and you're like, is this a spectacle case? Is it a telescope case? And it's a kaleidoscope. And you still enjoy it. You still think that this is something that has been
cabinet
crafted.
Of curiosities.
Yeah, it's galvanizing and it's energetic and it's diverting. That makes it sound like frippery, and it's not that either. But I rarely with books do I want to reread it. To reread the book. I want to return to this now and see whether it could be read in a different way or whether I could make assumptions about characters with different relationships between them, draw different lines and see what shape emerges out of the kind of dot-to-dot that he's created.
Did anyone else actually have to do that? Because I found in order to get who everyone was, then because also there's all the false leads whereby one person has resonances of other plots and characters but is distinctly different to throw you
Yes,
off.
Yeah.
I like the Josipovici one.
He's making a lot of stuff unstable, which is that characters can be characters that have a kind of kernel to them actually can be just different people in these stories. And therefore we're not sort of seeing characters move across the stories. We're seeing kind of essences of characters deposited in different people across the story.
Or kind of compactions or conjured up ideas of an avatar for a person. Like there's that lecture, the kind of lecture notes that is obviously playing with the idea of Ern Malley and that kind of moment in Australian literature. Yeah. And that's done so, I mean, joyfully, but transparently, that then I started to wonder, well, I don't know Günter Grass well enough. Is it playing on notions in that text that keeps recurring as a text?
Yeah.
And again, that's something that is either a kind of joyful sight of ignition within the book, or it's something slippery that I didn't feel I had a handle of. Mm. And there's nothing wrong with that. I felt unsettled, and that's a nice teetering place for a reader to be. But I guess that is a reason why I'd want to reapproach it.
I mean, just one thing. I mean, you and he on a stage reading stories, people could listen to a story by you and a story by him and think these are not totally dissimilar writers.
This is where, again, on podcasts, I remove the mask. Hello, everyone.
Come on, you've got to do this in Australian accent.
But in a Brisbane accent.
Oh, yeah, definitely no comment. I take that as a massive compliment. And I like the unreliability, not only of narrators, but also narrative that's here. And I think there's a lot to trip over and there's a lot to kind of relinquish and relax into, but also to kind of stiffen at and find kind of fang-like and toothy and uncomfortable. And that's a nice position to be in as a reader, unless at the end you feel you have to look up whether it is fulfilling a promise that it's made.
But it also, I think, interestingly, that he and you will allow certain passages where just the language does the work. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, you can
marvel at that.
Yeah, and character can pull back. Any sense of story can pull back. And the language, the writerliness, just does the work.
And I think that is the sheer pleasure of reading it, actually. And I think also what Ellie is saying about you want to go back, so do I. And I have to because I missed one of the Republic of Conscience Prize submissions for this year. But you know, so many times you don't want to proceed further with a book, perhaps one doesn't, or get to the end, and certainly not reread.
But there's also, I think it's with this book, one chooses to reread it because you feel completely confident that more will disclose itself.
Yeah, that there will be the reward of rereading.
It's not. It's not that we have to reread it because we're not. We're not getting something. Mm. It's so, and the pleasure will be. I mean, I reread the first 50 pages. The pleasure will remain, and it will disclose itself. And that's to arrive at that point at the end of a debut. One does it with Ellie, of course, but is not faint praise at all.
No, I agree, and something that's, you know, under the radar, a book that's under the radar, a press that's under the radar. I think that's really
perfect. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Ellie. That was brilliant. Now it's time for Jonathan McAloon's Small Press Book of the Month. But before we hear what Jonathan thinks of the book he's chosen, we're going to hear a brief extract from the author who I interviewed this morning. And the whole interview will be posted as a special next week. So here is Matthias N.R. Can you just tell me, before we talk about a couple of other things, just tell me what of the... of the elements of the story, did you discover that made you think, I want to write about this?
Yes. I wrote this book 10 years ago, just when I was writing Zone, at the same time, more or less. And I was living in Rome at that time. Just by chance, I read the biography of Michelangelo. I remember very well the sentence. It said that, and then Michelangelo received an invitation from the Sultan of Constantinople. And I said, what? Michelangelo?
Yeah.
Michelangelo in Istanbul. But the book didn't say why or to do what. So I began researching and what was this trip for and what was this invitation about. And Ascanio Condivi, the first biographer of Michelangelo, says that it was to build a bridge that Bajazet, Bajazet II, invited Michelangelo to build a bridge. And that was, for me, something incredible. I say, but then there was nothing. We didn't know nothing. Yeah. And you know, it was in Florence at that time.
Yeah.
And then a month later, he went to Bologna and then went back to Rome. And so I asked historians, specialists of the period, I said, well, is it possible that Michelangelo indeed went to Istanbul for this commission? And they told me, no, it's not possible. I said, why? Why is it not possible? And they said, we would know that.
So, Jonathan, tell us what is and about your Small Press Book of the Month.
Okay, so the book is called Tell Them of Battles, Kings and Elephants by Matthias N.R. And it's on Fitzcarraldo Editions. And Matthias N.R.'s novel Zone, which was like a 600-page sentence with this spy thinking about atrocities and also a train journey, that was the first novel that Fitzcarraldo published, wasn't it? So that was kind of their announcement. And this one, which, if I'm correct, you said before, Neil, this was written before Zone.
He was writing Zone at the time.
Right, okay.
So it's published originally in France in 2010.
This book, one.
But it's been brought out because I think Fitzcarraldo obviously had the confidence of his three internationally acclaimed novels published in English before that. So they were able to publish this very slim novella.
Yeah. So it's a historical novella, which I get talking about the way it involves itself with the historical form, but it's essentially about three prospective months in the life of Michelangelo, the sculptor, in 1506, when he's invited to build a bridge for the Ottoman Sultan in what was then called Constantinople, a bridge across the Golden Horn, creating
the Bosphorus.
The River Bosphorus, but it was the gold across
the Golden Horn.
It's
the Golden Horn, isn't it?
Which is joining east to west.
Joining east to west. So,
in one level, one sense of the geography, at least.
So he's been asked to go there, and what we know about the artist was he did receive an invitation. He probably didn't take it up, but NR has created from bits of document and also from his own imagination. And also we can tell by a little note at the end when he almost makes a case that this might have happened and there is evidence for it, that it's also a theory he has. Whatever it is, it's sort of a hypothetical period in this artist's life. And can I just say that I love the idea and I hope there'll be many more novels about little periods of time in not forgotten people, but forgotten realizations of people. I think it's a lovely way of doing a form which is traditionally kind of frivolous and unwieldy or considered quite a difficult prospect to balance between literary merit and satisfaction of a reader. So essentially when, in this version, Michelangelo goes to Constantinople, and what happens is he sort of just flaneurs about Constantinople. He writes down shopping lists. He is quite a reticent person, falls for this androgynous, could-be woman singer, and is loved by this poet, who's also the secretary of the Grand Vizier. And he's supposed to make this bridge, and he comes up with it. But the most important thing that happens for the reader is that you get this engagement with history, and you feel you're not made, you're not set there, oh, and he was wearing a rich ermine cloak, as the merchants then did. You know, it's not that kind of thing. It's just he has prejudices, yeah, which he just lapses mm-hmm. into. You know, he doesn't know the servants are there. He believes in God very presently. None of this is really explained, and it's all delivered in these little, barely paragraph-length chapters, which...
Do you want to read it?
Beautifully translated, as all of his books in English are, by Charlotte Mandel. Yeah. I mean, you know, an extraordinary act of translation.
If you can pick, Catherine, if you can pick a nice bit for me to read, I will definitely... But the one of the things which is lovely about the way it's written is that it engages with the old ancient registers and rhetoric mm-hmm. of how things would be written or how people would speak then without it being, you know, forsooth my lord. But there's the ghost of that. And there's all the rhetoric and there's all the inversions.
Yeah.
There's this kind of pushing of the ancient sort of register against what we can now read with pleasure, which I think has done really well. So,
I mean, I just want to say, I spoke to him this morning, and I just so wanted to believe that it happened. That when I talked to him about it, and he was saying, no, it really, really probably didn't. I was like, oh, but it has done, because it's now in the book. The book has allowed this wonderful thing.
You see, it didn't concern me whether it happened or not.
No.
That's the one that Michelangelo would have wanted you to feel, I think, as well.
So Johnny's now going to read a little bit.
So in this part, it's quite near the beginning, and he's just arrived in Constantinople, and it's about a page long. The days pass, and Michelangelo begins to wonder if he has made a mistake. He is hesitant to write a letter to His Holiness, get back in favour and go back to Rome, never. In Florence, the statue of David has made him the hero of the city. He could accept the commissions they won't fail to give him when they learn of his return, but that would unleash the fury of Julius, by whom he is employed. The idea of having to humiliate himself once more before the pontiff whips him into a frenzy. He breaks two vases and a majolica plate. Then, having calmed down, he begins drawing again, mainly anatomical studies. 3 days later, after Vespers, writes Ascanio Condivi, he receives a visit from two Franciscan monks who arrive soaked from the pounding rain. The Arno has swollen a lot over the past few days. People are worried it will flood. The servant helps the monks dry off. Michelangelo observes the two men, their robes spotted with mud at the hem, their ankles bare, their calves thin. Maestro, we come to give you a message of the highest importance. How did you find me? Michelangelo thinks amusedly that Julius II has very mediocre envoys. Through your brother's discretions, Maestro. Here is a letter for you, Maestro. It is a singular request coming from a very high personage. The letter is not stamped, but sealed in foreign characters. Michelangelo cannot help but feel disappointed when he sees that it does not come from the Pope. He puts the missive down on the table. What is it about? It is an invitation from the Sultan of Constantinople, maestro. We can imagine the artist's surprise, his little eyes opening wide. The Sultan of Constantinople, the Great Turk. He turns the letter over in his hands. Vellum is one of the softest materials there is. So that's just before he goes to Constantinople, but it's the vellum.
Yeah.
It's the vellum thing where it's not the, and the merchant was wearing ermine befitting of his status as a rich man.
The imagining the little eyes as well. You know, you're actually there observing it, and it carries on like that, where it's almost like you can see him if you just glance across the road, and you can see him working in the room. You know, I think it's very present.
It plays with that distance, between Michelangelo with, you know, a first name and a surname, and then the one we know. Yeah,
Before he was Michelangelo,
he's just one name like Madonna.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's a bit like Hilary Mantel in Wolf Hall, that she's
plunges you straight into the immediacy.
Yes, she's not wearing the research lightly. It's like the research is there, and it's been internally internalized. Yep. And none of it is in there apart from in the writing of it, that she knows what not to put in and what to put in.
Yep.
So you essentially, in his rooms, the idea that his you just know how uncomfortable and useless his small bed is. You know, you know what they're drinking probably tastes vaguely disgusting. All of these things are just...
That their clothes aren't adequate enough for the weather. You know, it's...
Yeah.
And then the sort of pleasure and the shock when he arrives in Constantinople and this whole new, different world. I think also we ought to say a little bit about Matthias Ennard as this scholar of Persian and Arabic and a man of enormous erudition who has written... I would describe it perhaps as a loose trilogy about Europe and the Middle East today, novelistically, in terms of his own Street of Thieves and Compass. And it's interesting to read this earlier book that was written earlier, almost as something that he kind of casually sort of tossed off while these other, you know, these more longer, perhaps more disquisitional and existential books were being written.
It'd be a lovely break, wouldn't it? A really clearing, be a palate cleanser of a
exercise. Maybe, absolutely, like an amuse-bouche or something before the main course. But
interestingly, the same thing in all four novels, a character travels in at least one direction from east to west. There is always that border is crossed.
And in fact, he said, because I also had the pleasure of interviewing him yesterday at the Festival of Italian Literature, as we've just touched on earlier in the podcast, he said that this is not a metaphor about borders and about bridges. So he's very much of the opinion that, you know, we all have to travel somewhere and come from somewhere. And I think that's very important in the context of the situation in Europe today where, you know, and of course, you know, with ourselves in the UK at the moment, we're all about internalising and being insular and closing in on ourselves and pulling up those drawbridges.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He's not looking for kind of all-embracing metaphors. He's saying... People make these journeys, whether they're migrants from the Arab Spring up through Spain, or whether they're scholars, almost in a kind of remembering those journeys in Compass. The narrator just moves further and further east as the book goes on. Equally in Zone. The documenter of all these terrible war crimes has gone to these places. It is about place and not metaphor or symbol.
It's also about, as Jonathan was saying earlier, about somebody you think you know the sort of vague history of, and of course it's there in all of his artifacts. Somebody like Michelangelo, is that you expect them to be stuck in the place that you think of them as originating from, and to have moving them and shifting them to somewhere else, and also reminding us that travel was much more common in the 16th century than and commerce and etc. and bartering, Sorry, I'm sounding a bit like my sort of O-level history.
No, you're not. Not
but, no, but we tend to put historical figures in static positions, I think. Mm. And I think that's what's so completely absorbing about this book. I think maybe a little bit as well about the quote and the title of the book, which is from Kipling's Life's Handicap, because it's a really beautiful quote. Maybe, Johnny, you'd like to read it.
Sure. Tell them of what thou alone hast seen, then what thou hast heard. And since they be children, tell them of battles and kings, horses, devils, elephants and angels. But omit not to tell them of love and such like.
Yeah, so, I mean, he as a storyteller, it's the idea that apparently in the actual book, it's Kipling goes and meets a sage who says... And he says, what do you do? He says he's a writer. And he says, oh, you're a kind of scribe for people who can't write. He says, no, I'm a writer. I make up stories. And that's the advice that the sage gives him, which is that, you know, that you've got to do the battles and kings and the elephants, but the job of a writer is actually underneath it. That is the serious stuff. And actually, that's one of the things I think about Matthew Sennard. He is a deeply serious writer. But there are, in all of his books, battles, kings, and elephants. And I say, it's kind of an interesting, kind of, you know, uber title for actually the work he's doing.
Mm. He reminds me very much, I was thinking this yesterday, of Orhan Pamuk in some ways in his writing.
Now I have to go and find another strange capital and read his books, because that's what you do to me every week.
You could go to Istanbul and you could read My Name Is Red.
I have read that. I've read that. No, and I've read the absolutely brilliant Museum of Innocence.
Well, Snow is the one that I like very much, because that's really more about Turkey's divided soul, if you like. But I think it's very interesting that he's setting it. And it's published now when, you know, we're looking at Turkey's position. Not just political, but geographical. So I think it's a timely book.
But once again, like, you know, a very short book with 100 pages, with a lot of space on the page. But
almost looks aphoristic. It's one of those kind of modern...
Yeah, exactly.
Attractive, fashionable ways of writing things.
But one can read it for the joy of reading it, irrespective of cultural resonances, all the kind of ways we might bring to reading of a text. It can be read for pure pleasure again. Okay. That's it. Thanks to Eli Williams, who joined us this week. Thank you to Catherine Taylor and Jonathan McAloon. If you want to support us, do go to Patreon and look for the Republic of Consciousness, and you can get a lot of free books from small presses. The music playing us in and out is from our court composer, Doofus. This track...
AKA Neil Griffiths.
No, not... if only...
Everybody thinks it's you, Neil.
Do you think I would be doing this and writing novels if I could... this track. Sorry, George. This. I don't know. Hey, I really don't know what to say.
Take it away, MC Griffiths.
Yeah. This track is called New York Boogaloo, elevator version.
Doggy dog.
Thank you. Much love, and may peace be upon you.